arise O merciful God, from whom comes all kinds of wisdom and understanding. We humbly ask you to guide and assist us in our deliberations and in our work. May all our efforts be directed to the welfare and good of our community and our country. May we act honorably in pursuit of true justice for all our people, now and for the future, and for generations still to come. Amen. Meeting of Parliament, Wednesday, 30th of February, 2019. May I have the minutes of correct? Communications from the church, petitions, announcements, papers to be made, the Honourable the Chief Minister. We have the item here on the table, the amended annual report of the Gibraltar Police Authority for the year ended the 31st of March 2017. Thank you, all the members of the that we need to table this amended version of the report.
The Honourable the Minister for Tourism, Employment, Commercial Aviation and Sport.
I think I have the honour to lay on the table the account of the Gibraltar Port Authority for the financial year ended 31st March 2015. Over to them.
Report to committee. Answer to all questions. We commence with question number 95/2019, the Honourable Ian Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, where do these rocks being dumped in the Sea of Colin Island originate? And can government state for what purpose they are being dumped there? And if the works have been subjected to a full environmental impact assessment, and if this has been presented to the DPC?
I offer the Honourable the Minister for Culture, the Media, Youth and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, the rocks being placed off Colin Island originate from the works at Lastly Parade Ground to construct the new sports facility. A substantial amount of limestone bedrock is being broken out, which is similar to the rock used for sea defense structures, and this is being temporarily stockpiled for use in future sea defense works. No environmental impact assessment has been undertaken, as these works are not reclamation. But before work started, various key entities were consulted, including the Department of the Environment and the Gibraltar Port Authority. The town planning department were also informed. Arising from these consultations, a number of surveys were carried out, including a protected species survey and a seabed survey. A number of environmental measures have also been put in place, including the deployment of a protective beam fitted with a silk cutting fender.
I understand then that the work being stockpiled there, there would be an intention to lift it out again at some point in the future. And it just says, would it not have been more straightforward to have conducted such stockpiling on the east side reclamation?
The volume of the work generated is substantial. Therefore, on plan, the operation or footprint is the size of a football pitch and the running track over a depth of exceeding 6 meters. The first part of the work online would have required a very large footprint, which is similar or which is simply not available. So it would not have fitted on the east side because of the amount of rock that have been installed. So that is the answer, as in putting it on the east side. So it's not the top side of the east side.
And what's the message of the survey of how expensive the surveys really have said were conducted in order to protect the potential marine environment in that area? And why wasn't the option of actually conducting a proper environmental impact assessment, which would have assured us that there is no environmental damage being conducted to potentially endangered species in that area?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm quite satisfied that they did do the survey before they were stockpiled where they were. So much so that we actually had some species removed from the place because they are protected species. So that is how expensive the survey went. And we had some linkage removed from even some rocks before the stockpiling of these rocks. So I'm quite satisfied that this was done. And as I said in the answer to my question in the previous, the original question, there was no need for an EIA at this point. The EIA would have to be done once it has become the rocks are moved to become part of the reclamation, but not stockpiling at this present time.
Just one more question, Mr. Speaker, as the Minister raised the subject of the Olympics, about which I'm not an expert, but I'm aware that the last time the Olympics were relocated, the entire rock was removed. It wasn't a case of removing the Olympics from the rock because some of that was damaging the country for the Olympics. Is the Minister saying that entire rocks were removed from the area, and if so, at what cost?
Well, Mr. Speaker, in this case, although it took about three or four days to remove them, well, it wasn't removing the whole rock. It was actually removing the species to some other area, which is pretty easy to do, if you know how to deal with it.
My name is Mr. Speaker, I have a curiosity, and I'm always thirsting for knowledge, too. The Minister said at the end of the answer to the original question that they have placed a fake curtain. Could you enlighten that man on that mentally what a fake curtain is?
Mr. Speaker, in my answer, I have spoke, but I am correct to be able to use the silk for the silk.
Mr. Speaker, I can be interested. I believe that what you have is a silk curtain that holds in silk.
So, in order
for there not to be a silk curtain, in order for there not to be silk going everywhere, you put in a silk curtain which holds in the silk. I don't know whether the protected species was a member of the GOP, for example, because you're in the back or an input or whatever it is, but the silk curtain prevents the silk affecting the protected species.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can the Minister, a couple of supplementary, can the Minister actually quantify under the cubic meter how much it expects in terms of rock to be using its own with stockpiles there? And I'm thankful for the fact that the Minister said this is not a reclamation project, and of course, only the stones will be used later on, and I presume what he was telling the Minister was then there will be an exercise at some point in the future to actually go back. Put them up now, they've been dropped and moving somewhere else. It probably involved some cost. But having actually witnessed the dumping of a lorry with these rocks, into that area, there's also going to be a time when there's a limit to how many rocks you dump in the same area, and there's going to have to be some form of reclamation in order to continue to fill in the area. And so the minister advised with a project, and these rocks are presumably going to break the surface and de facto return the area into the pure land. Or is there anything involved in this stockpiling of rocks, which effectively will set up a land road surface in that area? The original was asked whether we have information as to the cubic meters of rock that we expect will be taken from the site. We do have that information. It's 65,000 cubic meters that are expected. Now, Mr. Speaker, the Labour government, in relation to the rest of this question, knows, and I don't think it arises from this, but I'm happy to assist the House and not require him to ask a specific question, knows that we have already announced that there is going to be a reclamation in front of Curling Island. So the reasoning is that, therefore, for using this site, that we will be able to move the rocks to form part of the revetment. Now, 65,000 cubic meters of rock might sound like a lot, but may not even be enough to finish the revetment of the sort of reclamation that we envisage being in that area, although part of it may involve paper being used rather than just rock revetment. And given the cost of double handling rock and other such materials, we will reduce the cost considerably by having the rock in that location and simply having to displace the rock rather than having to once again truck them down to the area. We put them on the east side, for example, which would have cost twice again because of the double handling that would have been involved. And it's been very grateful to the Chief Minister for the additional information. For safety continues. And I quite understanding then we'll have to be exactly up with red stuff at some point in the future and located in the wherever the sea wall would be in the future.
I think you're the only using the wrong momentum. I don't think you can drag a rock. I think you can displace a rock, you can move a rock. But as he and I know, once something heavy is underwater, it's much easier to move, including me, for example. The Labour government will understand that moving a rock from underwater is easier than moving a rock from Rapley to the east side and then moving it from the east side up to Curling Island.
Question number 96 is Cameron and Jacobs.
Does the Canada government state what steps, if any, are being taken by the Trust Broadcasting Corporation to ensure that subtitles for local programmes on television are available for the hearing impaired?
Question the end of the list of subtitles for the media, youth and sport.
Mr. Speaker, do you feel that we provide closed captioning of the hearing or the hearing impaired and its video on demand service by a BBC player that can be found on the corporation's website? Subtitles are available within 48 hours of the program first airing on BBC TV. The corporation is currently investigating the possibility of introducing an element of subtitles on air, although this does not include live programs, which would require a significant investment in technology and or the recruitment of additional specialist personnel.
I thank the Minister for the answer to that particular question. A number of people have approached me with their impediments in relation to this particular issue in the subtitles. And obviously, it's well aware of the federal guidance notes, the first one to December 2013, in respect to accessibility for people with hearing and visual disabilities. And latterly, on the 17th of March 2017, in which certain observations were made to the technical aspects of subtitling. Is the Minister aware of those particular guidance notes issued by the BRA? And I'm inviting to at some point, perhaps not today, comment on those to me privately, because I would like to know whether or not subtitles can be provided on BBC News, for instance. Because many people with hearing impediments get the news quite late. Late, as you say, 48 hours later, and it would be very helpful for members of our community that do have hearing difficulties to follow the news when it's delivered. And if the minister could give some information about the possible costing of the significant cost that the minister alludes to, that would be helpful.
Well, Mr. Speaker, it is not possible to give the costings of what is still at the investigation process. But more BBC is investigating, and the part of it says that it's on air. Is like, for example, the news could well be subtitled when it goes on at 11 o'clock rather than the 8:30 one. So those are the things that have been looked at. And I am aware of what the UGRO is saying, and I'm also aware because we've had representations from the fraternity of people who are hearing impediments. So it is a thing that GDC is taking seriously, but again, it has to be in proportion to the financing and the availability of technology, and also whether it is actually a thing that if we can provide it in another way, we will do so.
Question number 97, the honourable Andrew Higgins.
Further to the answer provided to question number 595 of 2017, is the Minister for Sport now in a position to inform the South of government's plans for the relocation of the shooting facilities presently sited at Europa Park?
I'm the Minister for Culture, the Media, Youth and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, it is now public knowledge since the whole of the project was presented to the Development and Planning Commission, which is a public forum for guidance and advice. The area in the North Mall has been identified to build a shooting range. The building will include stores, car parking spaces, and offices, which is much needed in the area.
Question number 98, Labour
Eagle Hills. Further to the answer provided to question number 8 of 2018, and the Minister for Sport has told this out in respect of the grade 9 that was on the Minister's assistant post, which was vacant within the support of sport and labour authority.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Culture, the Media, Youth and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, the GSLA, the Broker Sports and Labour Authority, has currently advertised this post internally within the public sector.
Question number 99, Labour Eagle Hills.
Can the Minister for Sport inform the House of any staff vacancies or posts which are currently waiting to be filled on a substantive basis within the Board of Sport and Leisure Authority?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Culture, the Media, Youth and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, there are currently 5 vacancies of pool operators lifeguard. Closing date was yesterday, Tuesday the 13th of February.
Mr. Speaker, may I think we confirm that we come to that from there, that there is no other post that's been hired in an acting basis by someone, no lower grade acting for a higher grade. Is that the correct assumption?
Yes, sir. Question number 100, the Honourable Eagle Hill.
Can the Minister for Sport inform this House how many cancellations have been necessary at any of the Board of Sport and Leisure Authority facilities since the 1st of January 2018, indicating the location, date, and reason for the cancellation?
Mr. Minister for Culture, the Media, Youth and Sport.
Since the allocations at the Victoria Sports Hall were cancelled due to water injuries on the following date: the 9th of January 2019, 14th of January, 28th of January, and 4th of February
If you keep it last time I asked this question, I had to follow from the minister kindly for that information. What I really mean when I put down devoted special ed facilities. Last time I said in manageable foundation to include the swimming facilities, you know, what is sometimes commonly known as the gap facilities. That's not just in quantify some further. I know that perhaps technically a facility may fall under a school ground, for example, in dance school, but yet after 2 hours, it is commonly known and recognized that we can't devote a special lecture authority facility. I mean, the minister has that information at hand, so he may need to find it.
Maybe to speak to the case, if the honourable member would have asked that, I think it would have been honourable minister for education who would have answered that. Although the GSLA is in charge, and as you well know, is in charge of the allocation of the school, it is not in charge of the maintenance or the upkeep of the facility. And therefore, if the question is with the local liberal authority facility, technically, the schools are not the GSLA facility. They are the Department of Education facility. But if the honourable member wants to know about that, we can well put the question. But it's not the GSLA facility. These are school facilities belonging to the Department of Education, and therefore the Department of Education not deals with all the maintenance or issues like water ingress, for example, if we're going in any other school hall, and not the GSLA. So when he posed the question, it was the GSLA facility, and this is the only one that there has been water ingress.
Question number 101, Lambo in Georgia.
Can the Minister for Sport provide updated details of all payments made during this current financial year in respect of any sports related grants?
Thank you, the Honourable Minister for Sport for the Media and Youth and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, I now hand over the Honourable Member opposite the schedule in respect of all payments made during this current financial year in respect of any sports related grant.
Question 102, the Honourable Inder Hayes.
Can the Minister for Culture provide updated details of all cultural grants awarded during this current financial year?
Thank you, the Honourable Minister for Culture, Media and Youth and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, since my answer to question number W196-2017, one further cultural grant of £3,000 has been awarded to the Gibraltar IDF Dance Association in their participation in the IDF World and European Championships 2017 and 18. I take this opportunity to remind the Honourable Member that updated information is ready to be posted on the HMGOB website.
Question number 102, the Honourable Inder Hayes.
Can the Minister for Sport update the House with details of agreements entered into and payments made to date by the Gibraltar Football Association in respect of all facilities which they lease at the Kerry Stadium?
I'm the Honourable Minister for Culture, the Media, Youth and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer these questions together with question 104-106.
Question number 104, the Honourable Alan Thompson.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise that it has agreed to pay any compensation to operating and catering establishments in the Victoria Stadium complex as a result of the anticipated sale to the Gibraltar Football Association, and if so, to whom and in what amount?
Question number 105, the Honourable Alan Thompson.
the government confirmed that the $5 million is still recovered by the GSA in this current financial year are still expected to be paid before the 21st of March 2018.
Question number 106, the Honourable Alec Lennis.
Mr. Speaker, can the government confirm the length of the negotiations since the announcement was made in April 2017 and finalising the sale of the lease of the Victoria Stadium to the GSA will not result in the taxpayer being a worse off?
I'm afraid the Honourable Minister for Culture, Media, Youth and
Sports. Mr. Speaker, has the government announced on the 18th of April 2017 that it had reached an agreement with the GSA on the sale of the Victoria Stadium? The announcement stated that GSA would pay $16.5 million for the purchase of the land in three installments with funds exclusively provided by WEPA and FIFA. Two installments of $5 million each will be paid in the current financial year 17 and 18. The third payment of $6.5 paid in 2018-19. That is exactly what is going to happen. At present, HMGOG is working closely with the GSA in relation to the terms and conditions of the sale. There have not been a lengthy negotiations, as stated in the question from the Honourable Member, where there has been a careful coordination between the government and the Gibraltar Sports and Leisure Authority and the GSA as to how to manage the transition period. As Honourable Members know, the sports board is part of the sale. Therefore, all sporting associations who regularly use these facilities, including the track and field, are to continue to use them and will do so for a period of time while all the other wonderful facilities are being constructed. There is only one operator having a catering establishment in the Victoria Stadium, and we are still negotiating terms and conditions with the directors. The taxpayer will certainly not be worse off, but much better off. Better off with a football acquiring a top four national football stadium, two alternative pitches for domestic games at all levels, sufficient training facilities and pitches to meet all demand within Gibraltar for at least two indoor football pitches. Gibraltar club will be better since they are no longer need to train in Spain. They will be able to base all their training needs in Gibraltar. Rugby and cricket will be better off and be able to enjoy their own state-of-the-art facilities at Europa Point. Indoor sports and cultural entities will be better off since they will be able to enjoy new and more modern multi-purpose halls at Europa Point, in addition to the continued use of the Centenary Hall and the rest of our Bayside area. State government will also have funds available to invest in hockey and other sports like table tennis, as has been seen with a new refurbished court at Bayside. All of will assist basketball, netball, volleyball, badminton, squash, amongst others. That will be better, since they finally will have an area they desperately need and deserve, which they have been seeking since 1968, given their international achievements. Athletics will be better off when they obtain an enhanced 400-meter track at Rathley Oil Parade. Swimming will be better off with a new, much-needed 54 indoor pool. Premises for associations and clubs, offices, medical facilities, treatment rooms, and boardrooms are all being included in all these facilities being developed. A specific new facility has already started for our Special Olympians, who have done a crowd so many times. And all facilities will be made available to our schools. The taxpayer is already benefiting through a huge economic activity and investment on the infrastructure without costing a penny to the taxpayer. The benefit will be seen when we see 2,500 athletes coming to our shores
for the Army Games in 2019. 2,500 athletes will be singing all our hotels. Friends and family who will be accompanying the athletes and will drink and eat in our bars and restaurants during the 9 days they will be here. Therefore, all businesses will be better off. After the Iron Games, all our facilities will be the legacy of the Games, with these new facilities capable of bringing to Gibraltar many more people to form part of the form, in the form of events such as athletic meets, rugby sevens and 15 tournaments, international swimming competitions, and more local tournaments. The association is keen to host amongst others. The fact that international football will be played here is yet another benefit to our taxpayer and our economic and economy generally. All in all, a win-win situation, not only for the taxpayer, but for our children, our young people, and even our elderly. I would at this point like to give my sincere thanks to all sports associations who have been very cooperative in working with us together. All the facilities will comply with all international requirements, and also for being patient and helpful during these 2 years, transitional periods in which there are disruptions due to all the construction going on.
You see that in my own question, that was number 103. The Minister has reminded us of the agreement entered into with the Football Association and even the target payment date and so on. But my question does say the payments made to date of the association. I haven't heard the Minister confirm the figure of what payments have been made to date.
Mr. Cooper, as I said in my lengthy answer, there hasn't been any figures yet because of the leases. We are looking at leases, we're looking at contracts, we're looking at agreements, as my answer stated. So, whether the honourable member says that it has any money passed, the answer is no, but I am that we are guaranteed, and the part of the agreement was that it will be paid before the end of this financial year, the amount that was to install it.
And I'm grateful to the Minister for an example. If you could perhaps come back to my specific question in respect to the occasion of one catering establishment in the stadium complex, can you mention why whether this catering establishment has a license agreement from the government or a lease, and has the occupier or the operator of this catering establishment indicated to the government any sums of money they will be seeking in terms of compensation at this stage? And furthermore, I remind the Minister grateful for his clarification they expect the 10 million by the end of financial year. But the my calculation is 45 days to get it in.
Mr. Speaker, as in the occupier of the rent operator having a catering establishment, we call it a stadium, he has a lease, and we are negotiating with him because half of the lease is where the GFL will be. So there is negotiation with it. But at the moment, we're still negotiating with the directors as to how we work that one out.
Question, Speaker. So you're negotiating with this individual relating to the level of compensation? Is that part of it?
No, I'm sorry, Mr. Speaker.
Either you are or you're not, I'm not too sure of the answer to that question. Not necessarily something an answer, Mr.
Speaker, when it's negotiations, it can be either one or the other. We're on negotiations, that's the word of the answer. If you're on negotiations, you don't know whether it's one or the other. You don't, that's the same negotiation.
Mr. Speaker, I can really call it maybe one question. Just coming back to finalising on the lease. Are the negotiations for the complete surrender release or partial surrender release?
Well, Mr. Speaker, as I said, we were negotiating issues. Question number 107, the Albert Pelletier.
The Canada government states the expected cost for the building of the university of Gibraltar Hall and the name of the contractor.
Answer the other one for the cost of the media news and sport.
Mr. Speaker, the exact cost of the project to develop accommodations in the area of the University of Gibraltar has not yet been determined. We are still in negotiations with the contractor in relation to certain items. The name of the contractor is the house.
Mr. Speaker, I can understand that perhaps there will be small items of construction in terms of materials, etc., which may affect the final money paid for this project, but certainly the government will have entered a contract with the contractor to provide this facility, and therefore there must be a ballpark figure towards this project for the allocation and the vehicles through which it will be financed.
We repeatedly have to deal with these issues in the house. I mean, the formulas of honourable members want us to get the worst possible deal for the taxpayer. Now, the honourable members have been told that we have not been able to finalise the figure, just because we are trying to get a better deal for the taxpayer than the one that has already been presented to us. And that some work can be done whilst other aspects of the contract are finalised. That's where we are. We have lengthy exchanges in this respect, in particular in relation to the magnificent car parking facility now provided in the centre of town, where we said repeatedly we would provide the information once we finalise the amounts to be paid, but we were pushing to ensure that the best deal for the taxpayer. Now, when you enter into an agreement with a contractor, the contractor is still negotiating with subcontractors, and if a price is given which the contracting party of the government has agreed with the contractor, then the subcontractor is able to work out how much he can squeeze the contractor for. Those are the issues, Mr. Speaker. And as soon as everything has been dealt with and finalised, we will be in a position to give a final figure and do so when it's not in the interest of the taxpayer to continue a negotiation to squeeze the best possible price. That's what we insist on doing. I would have thought we would have enjoyed the honourable member's opposite support for that.
Can the government explain what procurement procedure has taken place in the development of this project?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, we've sought quotes from a number of entities.
And can the government confirm whether this was the cheapest quote?
Mr. Speaker, I believe this was the cheapest quote for the work that the government required.
And finally, Mr. Speaker, has the government undertaken an assessment as to how these halls will be populated once the project is completed?
Of course, Mr. Speaker.
And is the government able to disclose that assessment?
Mr. Speaker, why would we disclose that assessment at this stage if we are not yet at the stage where the facility is finalised? What is it the honourable gentleman wants to know? If I should be asked specifically about that, we may be able to share some information with him. But he almost wants us to come up with the marketing brochure that we might use at the end. No, I mean, it doesn't make any sense. This is an attempt to work for everybody's time.
It's a simple fact. If we have a moment to, if there's no further to answer this question, I'd like to go back to question 101 when you do it. Well, I have to say this, but I think we need to finish the supplementary question first.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you. I'd like to keep him for commenting on the answer. I have one question for him. If he can advise the House, the cost of building these units, which I understand will be called residency units in Gibraltar, are these to be borne by the government entirely, i.e., through the Improvement and Development Fund, or is there some other mechanism? And am I correct in my understanding then that it is the intention of the government to get this building to United Gibraltar?
It's a bit of a number of questions there, not just one. The government is looking at various options to finance this build.
Thank you, Mr. In the figures provided as an answer to question number 101, I tried to have a quick look to the previous answer I had by a written question of 195 of 2017. I noticed that the heading seemed to have changed, which makes it rather difficult to track. But I thought, and I'd like to confirm, is that this is an updated list of what has been paid in Jafua. And if one looks at the 2017 answer, for example, there was a £709 expenditure towards prostituting, which in February 2018 does not appear in my schedule. It seems to have disappeared. Therefore, I'm giving the Minister a benefit of the doubt. It can't have been updated. Is it missing data that was there before? Are there a figure increases, or is it not the same, but it seems to have disappeared? And whereas in the previous study, the last time the Minister very kindly, very helpfully, put down grants awarded for hosting special states, allegedly then, for example, we had the Batman tournament, of which I know there's been a lot happening in that respect recently, I cannot find the Batman tournament in the update of February 2018. Maybe because I'm having a listing, as the heading of first granted to sporting society, probably means the same. Grants awarded to sporting associations, but I need the Minister to confirm that there are one week societies in the same association, and there's no heading at the top of the answer to the study of question 101, whereas there was in the previous one. Is the Minister for Information now, Mr. Speaker? You know, we are in a state of waiting just for more information. I don't mind delaying it, and the Minister can come back at a convenient stage when you allow for such a thing to be told properly and double check.
Because the first thing is the backgammon income on it. The Gibraltar can offer backgammon tournaments, 70,500. Which is 1, 2, 3, 3, 6, 9 down the line of the schedule. Gibraltar can offer backgammon tournaments. That's the first one. The second one that the annual member says about the target speaking, you don't know, even. This is the current one, so therefore, is the target seating has £700 when you asked the question before. It means that now we probably have applied for more money and it's updated to from 700 to target associated seating, 5,745. But given that the annual member is not happy with certain. I have no problem with going through it with the honourable member that we have done before and go through and see which is the one, because from the two that is mentioned, they are there and I have an explanation and I've just said it. But if he wants, I mean, it's up to him how he wants to tackle it.
Well, I didn't use the word target shooting, I used the specific title here with pistol shooting, because target shooting is what appears in the 2018 answer. And I have been looking for what was given in the 2017 answer, which was strictly. And in 2017, it was given under the heading Sports Awarded, sorry, Grant Awarded for Sports Development Project. And the Grant Awarded for Sports Development Project, neither Pistol nor Target. So Shooting Federation, just says, which is, you know, in my interpretation, that encompasses both Pistol, sorry, the Pistol, Pistol. Clay and Karen. So, at first glance, it was extremely difficult to decipher it. But I think the Minister has extended an invitation for us to meet perhaps behind the chair. We can do so, and then if one has to modify anything in hand.
It's my understanding of what pistols would be fired and what the target is. In any case, you might have to take behind our chair. Yes, we speak on this issue because, yes, there is, as you see, the honourable member, where he could be well confused, where he says, target speaking in one place, and then there's another one that says, speaking federation in the other. So, maybe there's three different associations and clubs of speaking. So, the speaking federation behind this picture.
Round of questions, man. Question number one, who do you know, why work to your mind?
Mr. Speaker, service question 231 of 2017, are the black cabs now available for purchase in Left Hand Drive, and has government finalised its agreement with the Gibraltar Taxi Association regarding their purchase? Mr. Speaker, no Left Hand Drive programs are available yet for the new black cab, the sixth model, and no agreement has been finalised with the Gibraltar Taxi Association.
Mr. Speaker, does the Minister have an update on when the Left Hand Drive might become available?
Mr. Speaker, the Left Hand Drive is starting to become available now. As a student, there is an order which has been placed for the first 25 units are currently in production for a company in the county of Holland. Those are just 25 units. At the moment, it's actually no availability for anyone else. Because they're just obviously they manufacture right hand drive vehicles and they've just started to move into the left hand drive and into the left hand drive territory.
Thank you, Minister, for that update. And I presume, therefore, we're a lot further than we were when I last asked this question in terms of being able to secure the vehicle. Therefore, in that light, has the Minister engaged, or has government engaged with the Taxi Association reference to purchase at all yet?
Mr. Speaker, the first thing that we have to do is to ensure that when these cars become available, they're suitable for devoted roads. Until the further steps aren't carried out, then we're not in a position to actually finalise or progress down the route of the negotiation with the GPA.
Question 109, the Honourable Questions.
Mr. Speaker, without disclosing the household itself, can the government provide a schedule on the number of parking permits issued per household since the recent laws of the parking schemes and residential buildings or roads the household belongs to?
The information requested by the owner member is set out in the schedule that I now hand over.
Question number 110. The Honourable T. M. Hammond on behalf of the Honourable D. O. Peter.
Mr. Speaker, when will the statutory review of the Georgia Financial Services Commission carried out in 2016 be published?
Mr.
Speaker, it is government's intention to publish the statutory review shortly. And that is the number I'm accepting in any way, but it's a 2016 statutory review because anything that's not what was completed.
I think this may not directly arise from the question, but can the Minister advise how much the exercise costs today?
Mr. Speaker, no, I can't open up what I can for him. Is that I record it with rather than the budget that the FSC have provided for in 2 years.
Mr. I know we've been around this particular board before. When the Minister says to it, I'm talking days, weeks, months, years.
It's a big problem. I mean, it's very, very short.
Question number 111, the Honourable T. M. Hammond on behalf of the Honourable D. O. Peterson.
as the Devolved International Bank obtained alternative trading facilities to enable it to offer banking facilities to cryptocurrency-related services service providers.
Also, the only way to come is to put this is commercially competitive. Question number 112, the Honourable Police Department.
It is just a fellow recent report in UK media relations to data cyber security vulnerability. Facebook and the company devoted its networks are safe from sabotage and attack.
People have demonstrated their communications infrastructure, the data center and official buildings with appropriate physical security measures in place. These ways can still personnel on site, CCTV and access control systems. Question number 113, the Honourable Alan Simpson.
Mr. Speaker, can the government confirm that the entire $22 million cost of the announced wastewater treatment plant will be borne by the improvement?
Okay, the minister. Is any other minister answering this question? Otherwise, we can defer it. Okay, we defer it, shall we?
Question 139, the Honourable E.J. Phillips on behalf of the Honourable D.A. Peterson.
Mr. Speaker, what does the government intend to do about illegal use of fireworks and water?
I'm for the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the government supports the celebration of the festive season with the New Year's Eve as traditionally known as discharging of fireworks. Some members of the left believe that this should be done in a safe, legal and responsible manner, and has for some years supported the awareness campaigns conducted by the GFRS and the Royal Water Police. As in previous years, customs, the Royal Water Police and the Water Fire Rescue Service jointly engaged in the annual awareness campaign. These highlights of fireworks are able to import, accepting the license granted by the collective customs. Warning about the possible criminal offences concerning the use and possession of fireworks in some circumstances, and setting up the firework code for the safe handling and use of fireworks. The campaign is promoted through social and traditional media outlets. As part of this campaign, the FRS Fire Prevention Officers distributed fireworks safety awareness flyers and placed posters at prominent locations. As an innovation, and in a bid to curtail the indiscriminate discharge of fireworks, in the run-up to the New Year's Eve celebrations, government introduced a sales embargo window for legally imported fireworks that restricted their sale between the 27th and 31st of December. This largely reduced the previously prevalent practice of the disturbing fireworks during the month of December and was hailed as a success by the Royal Water Police and the GFRS. And as the customs also continued with an enforcement activity at the land centre supported by African dog section officers with the explosive detection capability dog, which served as a valuable and powerful deterrent in respect of the illegal importation of fireworks. Government remains committed to the safe, legal and responsible use of fireworks in the festive season and will continue to promote similar campaigns in the future. Speaker, just one further question, and I thank the Minister for that answer. Does the Minister have any information relating to any the numbers of dangerous fireworks confiscated by customs during that particular period? Mr. Speaker, I do not have the answer to that specific question, but I would be happy to speak it from customs. What I do have is supplemental information to say that no one had been arrested
for the discharge of firearms. The one thing that we could do in that particular period would be to have a sort of amnesty bill where people are permitted to dump when firearms they have purchased, that customers want to come in with relevant warning erected at customers during a particular season. Maybe an idea the government may wish to consider. I know, as I said in the answer, that the RTP and customs do deploy dogs and during the particular season. They are very much aware of the attempt to report a unlawful fireworks, but as I also said in the answer, any fireworks can be reported legally under the license of the Director of Customs. But in respect of the particular question of the RTP, I don't have the information with me, but I'd be happy to ask for it.
Question number 140, the Honourable Edo Phillips, on behalf of the Honourable D.O. Putin.
Can the government confirm whether they are considering introducing electronic tagging of individuals as part of its reforms of the criminal justice system?
And for the Honourable Minister for Health Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, no.
Question number 141, the Honourable Edo Phillips.
Can the government state whether or not it intends to promote legislation before the House to strengthen measures in relation to sexual harassment in the workplace?
I'll give you over the Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the Crimes Act 2011 provides for offences which would capture the eventuality of sexual harassment type behaviour in any location, including the workplace. These offences can be found under Section 215. If the harassment includes physical contact. In cases where the harassment involves verbal abuse or visual representations, as well as following or monitoring of an individual, offences exist under Sections 88, 89, and 92 of the Act. These offences are all captured under Sections 3 and 4 of the Crimes Act, which in turn means that any conviction which carries a sexual element could trigger notification requirements by virtue of sentencing thresholds or the application of sexual offences prevention orders on the offender. The Act ensures the protection of victims of sexual assault and sexual harassment type of behaviour by ensuring legislation exists which criminalises this behaviour and allows for the monitoring of those convicted offenders through the multi-agency public protection arrangements process. Sexual harassment in the workplace is firmly prohibited by Section 14 of the Equal Opportunities Act 2006. The Equal Opportunities Act defines sexual harassment as any form of verbal, non-verbal, or physical conduct of a sexual nature or that is related to gender reassignment or sex that has the purpose or effect of violating an individual's dignity or creating an intimidating, hostile, degrading, humiliating, or offensive environment for that individual. This definition reflects international standards, including an EU definition that we are obliged to conform. A complaint for sexual harassment may be made to the Employment Tribunal. The Equal Opportunities Act includes a separate harassment claim in cases where an individual sees it less favourably because of that individual's rejection or submission to the conduct. Additionally, an individual subjected to less favourable treatment because they have made or intend to make a complaint under the Equal Opportunities Act has a right to claim for unlawful victimisation. I'm grateful to the Minister for explaining to me the statutory provisions in relation to criminal offences and indeed those that relate to equal opportunities and the ability of complainants to seek recourse through the Employment Tribunal in relation to complaints of sexual harassment in the workplace. I'm familiar with those. My question really was to see whether the Minister had any, if there's any indication of whether any of those laws would be strengthened. What I mean by that, in recent years, the United Kingdom government has been debating whether or not additional protection should be afforded to those that have suffered sexual harassment in the workplace by ensuring that those companies and those employers in that situation who have compromised claims, as it were, before the Industrial Tribunal or the Employment Tribunal, will not be allowed to hide away from those compromise agreements and that will be recorded within an organisation such as the Employment Tribunal. the fact that a complaint has been registered against that employer. So that's what I'm suggesting to the government, or asking the government, where the government intends to promote legislation to further protect individuals who have a complaint against sexual harassment against the employer, for instance, in the workplace, and whether or not they would consider whether those compromise agreements have been entered into by the employer and the employee. It might be obviously disclosed to the general public, but the fact that it be recorded that sexual harassment has been compromised in those circumstances with that particular type of employer. And what I put to him was, of course, that it's important that those who seek employment with our employers and understand that there have been complaints made against them in the past. And that is what I'm getting at. Of course, there's debate in many countries relating to this particular point of compromising claims. But I would ask the government to clarify whether it intends to bring legislation to permit them. It's not an area or a subject that I've discussed with any of my teams. It's not a matter of being referred to either by employers or the organised police. However, given that he raised it in the South, I will refer the matter to the organised police who will discuss it. But it seems, in any case, as though the subject relates more to a payment law rather than any amendment to the criminal law, in which case I will allow my honourable colleague to
just clarify the point. Yes, I was aiming particularly to give you back my question related to the workplace and strengthening measures in relation to sexual harassment.
Clearly, as Minister for Justice, Mr. Speaker, the Minister is answering the question from the context of the criminal law and the equal opportunity. But the question is directed specifically to the employment situation, that is correct.
The Honourable Minister for Justice has indicated this is not a matter that the government has given consideration to. It is a matter that we may well now need to consider. As I understand the Honourable Member's point, it is that whether there is a compromise arrangement, that there should be some form of register, some form of record that is publicly available to anybody that might possibly be seeking employment with that employer in the future. This is something that we will clearly need to consider and discuss and debate. But two immediate issues come to mind of concern in relation to the scheme. Firstly, the fact that there is going to be, or that there would be legislation requiring these compromise agreements, at least to form part of a register, even not the details of the compromise agreement, that may actually lead to a great deal of directives by employers to enter into a compromise agreement in relation to sexual harassment. It would need to be a record that the employer has, in some way, acknowledged sexual harassment and by entering into this compromise agreement. So that may add to the detriment of the employee by making employers reluctant to enter into such a compromise agreement. And the second issue is in relation to the register, which is which could be a public record. I really don't see how this could actually work in practice. If there's a compromise agreement could be made in relation to a complaint, an allegation, which may not necessarily be proven, which may not necessarily be subject to any particular finding, simply an internal issue between the employer and the employee, which they decide to compromise in a particular way. And as the Honourable Member will know, having, I'm sure, done many compromise agreements in the employment scenario in different aspects, that does not necessarily lead to any acknowledgement or acceptance of the fact. And therefore, a register where the employer could be seen to be acknowledging something simply on the basis of an allegation, that would be something which could perhaps lead to conclusions which may not necessarily be 100% correct, simply on the basis of tarnishing or judging entities, simply on the basis of allegations which may have been made and which have not gone, because of the compromise agreement, have not gone to an industrial tribunal or any kind of formal setting judicial setting without there being a particular finding. So those are two areas of concern. I'm not saying that this is not something that we need to consider, but having heard the Honourable Member for the first time on this issue now, these are two red lights that spring to mind and could cause some concern, certainly on our part.
I'm grateful for the answer by the Minister, and this is a hotly discussed topic in the United Kingdom at the moment for obvious reasons. But I would certainly argue that having legislation and provisions like this that would strengthen the rules against sexual harassment in the workplace would effectively prevent it from happening in the business. There's no argument to suggest that strengthening our measures would prevent employers from abusing their positions and prevent this from happening in the first place. But look, it is a difficult subject, I agree. But I take it that the government has not, as a result of that, sort of intended to look at this in any detail at this stage.
I will answer that the point. The government has not played the stance to the possibility of considering this, but there is a matter of public interest, public concern, which we would have to look into.
In the wake of the issues arising out of sexual harassment in Westminster, would the government be looking at implementing a code of conduct for Parliament and parliamentarians on sexual harassment?
That panel is under consideration at this moment in time. It isn't. That's a method way around.
Absolutely.
I was the committee of this house. And that committee is not able to meet for the simple reason that most of the chamber, notably on the government side, the Chief Minister and the Deputy Chief Minister are otherwise occupied. But I would put it to honourable members that it is about time that perhaps a law card for the committee were to be formed, involving other ministers and other members of the opposition that could deal with these matters. The question of a parliamentary code of conduct is well overdue in my view. Otherwise, I think the work that commission did has been wasted. The years go by and it hasn't been done. And I know that the Chief Minister is committed to it, but he is physically and deputy unable to deal with the matter. And therefore, I would put it to the ministers who are here now that it is up to them, two or three of them, to take on this burden, the Minister for Labour, the Minister for Justice, they could take over the work in the Select Committee and get on with the work. There is a need, I think, for a parliamentary code of conduct.
Mr. President, we will certainly and firmly to discuss the Cabinet at our next meeting in a moment.
I commend you on that precisely. Just in relation to our part, we stand ready to participate in that.
Speaker, by when could we expect some kind of briefing or answer on these cabinet discussions?
Speaker, it is impossible for us to give briefings on cabinet discussions, but we're not concluding with the right job, I'm sure that it will be communicated about it.
There can be an assistance on this point as leader of the House in respect of the issue of the parliamentary code of conduct. But there is a code of conduct prepared by the government. It sits behind honourable gentlemen. We have it here. It's available online. The government is entirely committed to it. The only reason we have not progressed that is because the GOC asked us to take it to the Select Committee, Mr. Speaker. And that's the reason why the Select Committee was created. It is true, I've heard you from inside, that the government has unfortunately been dealing with other matters which have made it impossible for us to progress with the Select Committee. And indeed, the fragmentation of the opposition has made it impossible to progress with the Select Committee as constituting therefore it would be necessary to ensure fairness, in particular in the context of a code of conduct for members of the House, not just for ministers, to amend the composition of what the recommendation to include both the independent honourable members. That is an issue which I think the Honourable Deputy Minister has already dealt with today in the context of the composition of the Committee on Brexit, and we intend to deal with in the context of the Committee on the Code of Conduct. And I'm quite happy to commit to the House to try and do that before the half break for Easter, Mr. Speaker, so that we are able to finalise these matters that quickly. This is something I wanted to see happen from the moment I was elected to the House, and indeed I committed to see happen from the moment that I became Chief Minister. The entreaty from the GOC was that we should not progress with the code without then having the opportunity to deal with it in the committee. I think we are there. I don't think there is anything more to debate in this context, but I want to give honourable members, in particular the independent members, the opportunity to consider.
Just on the point that the Chief Minister makes in relation to this, we've said categorically we stand ready to participate in this process quite clearly, but it is certainly wrong to suggest that it describes it as a fragmented opposition. It's quite clear we stand ready to participate in this process. The world did not stop the day that the United Kingdom decided to leave the EU.
We
The advocacy recognizes that it is its responsibility to ensure
for the systems must always comply with all relevant legislation to ensure its legality and legitimacy. The external public CCTV systems will only be used as far as it's necessary for public safety, the prevention and detection of crime or public disorder. The code of practice also ensures that evidence is stored, retained, and made available as required so that there is absolute respect for everyone's right to a fair trial. The advocacy professional standard department is responsible for the effective management of the systems and ensuring the integrity and quality of the operating system for evidential purposes. The professional standards department conducts audits on the operation of the RGP systems and complies with this code of practice. Audits include examination of the monitoring room record and content of record material. All cameras are protected with an area suitably sized to alert the general public of their presence. The CCTV system has a privacy mask feature, which allows for all windows and private areas to be masked out. The privacy mask setting will be applied to blackout private areas which are not intended to be viewed or recorded. The CCTV system is therefore only view and record images of public areas that are within its field of view. A member of the public who can register a complaint with regard to any aspect of the RGP system may do so in accordance with the Data Protection Act 2004. Any performance issues identified will be considered under the disciplinary procedures to which all police CCTV operators are subject.
Can you just confirm them? Because I seem to recall asking a question along these lines some time ago, and it became apparent that the RGP were not the only authorities with CCTV systems in Gibraltar, and that perhaps Customs and the Environment Agency and other. Do the same rules apply, or have they all been now brought under the single agency of the RGP?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, compared with the Honourable Deputy Minister and the Honourable Minister for the Environment and their standalone systems.
And can you mention in some of the same rules that we've just described as applying to the RGP system apply to those systems also, or are there the main rules?
I think there is close liaison between the Department of Environment and the RGP. We follow their code of practice, and in fact, the people are questioned. I think it's one person who actually looks at CCT, but it is always in contact with RGP and has received training from the RGP.
Question number 143, the Honourable E.J. Phillips on behalf of the Honourable D.A. Pinton.
Mr. Speaker, as at the 31st of December 2017, how many individuals were employed directly by the Care Agency and Elderly Residential Services?
I'm for the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and
Justice. Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 143 to 148.
Question number 144, the Honourable E.J. Phillips on behalf of the Honourable D.A. Pinton.
Can the government state how many workers as at the 31st of December 2017 employed directly by the Care Agency were on fixed-term contracts?
Question number 145, the Honourable E.J. Phillips on behalf of the Honourable D.A. Pinton.
People as at the 31st of December 2017, in what department within the GHA were the workers employed by the GHA on fixed term contracts working in?
Question number 146, the Honourable E.J. Phillips on behalf of the Honourable D.A. Pinton.
Can the government state how many workers as at the 31st of December 2017 employed directly by the GHA were on fixed term contracts?
Question number 147, the Honourable D.A. E.J. Phillips on behalf of the Honourable D.A. Pinton.
can the government state how many workers add up to 31st December 2017 working within Lancelonia on fixed-term contracts?
Question number 148, the Honourable E.J. Phillips on behalf of the Honourable D.A. Susan.
Of the previous three questions concerning fixed-term contracts within the co-agency, the GHA and Lancelonia, please provide a schedule setting out A, how many successive fixed-term contracts each worker has been engaged on, and B, each were first engaged on the first contract.
I to the end of the Minister for Health Care.
Mr. Speaker, as of the 31st of December last year, the care agency employed 538 individuals, of which 316 were deployed within the elderly residential services. The total number of workers as of the 31st of December of last year, employed directly by the care agency on fixed-term contracts, was 24. As of the 31st of December of last year, workers employed by the GHA on fixed-term contracts were working in the following departments: ambulance services, medical department, nursing department, physiotherapy department, radiology department. As of the 31st of December of last year, there were 113 workers employed directly by the GHA on fixed-term contracts. It is important to note that out of those 113 workers, 68 are contracts of consultants and doctors who have been in fixed-term contracts for over 20 years. The government is confident that all consultants will enter into new and specifically negotiated contracts in the course of this year. To date, 18 consultants have now entered into their new contract. As of the 31st of December of last year, there were 2 workers employed on fixed-term contracts working within Lancelonia. I now hand over to the Honourable Gentleman a schedule setting out A, how many successive fixed-term contracts each worker has been engaged on, and B, the date each were engaged on their first contract.
Question number 149, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Mr. Speaker, further to the answers provided to question number 658 and 433 of 2017, can the Minister for Health say on which date the three staff nurses took up their posts on a substantive basis as to benefit to the AME department?
I'm to the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the three child nurses took up the substantive post at the AME department on the 2nd of January of this year.
Question number 150, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government state its position with respect to the funding of hearing aids for those suffering from hearing impairment and associated hearing conditions?
I'm for the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I'll answer this question together with questions 151 and 152.
Question number 151, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government state the position in respect to the funding of the maintenance of hearing aids issued by the GHA?
Question number 152, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government state the number of adults seen by the relevant departments at the GHA in 2016 and 2017?
I'm for the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the GHA offers hearing aids free of charge to all entitled patients following clinical assessment. The GHA finances the maintenance and repairs of all hearing aids issued. If the manufacturer's advice of the age or condition of a particular hearing aid is beyond economical repair, the patient is reassessed and issued with a new device. The audiology department saw 1,251 adult patients in 2016. And 1,267 last year.
speak on it. Perhaps I think it's fair that I'm going to speak on it. I am one of those that's put into the figure of 1251 in 2016 or 1254 in 2017. The minister said that it provides three or four hearing aids to those suffering from hearing impediment. Yes, Mr. Speaker, I know that some payments have to be made in respect of acquiring your first hearing aid. Are there certain conditions of why, for example, I have had to make a contribution? The way it was explained to me by the audiologist is I was not paying the full cost, it was subsidized. But certainly, payments have been made by many patients of which I am one of those personally affected.
There is no, according to the information that has been provided, I know we respect the information provided, there should be no cost whatever to any of our patients or entitled patients. The only thing that I can think of, although of course I will need to go back to the department and ask them specifically what the Honourable Gentleman has raised in this house today, but the only thing that I can think of may be that the specification for a particular hearing aid is set, but that the patient wishes to have a different model or a different type of hearing aid, and the difference is paid between the patient's choice and what is being advised. That is the only thing that I can think of, that it may be completely mistaken and interested, so it may not be that at all. So I will go back to the department and I will ask the question that the Honourable Gentleman has raised today.
I now heard the answer. That could well be a possibility, you know, as well. You may be entitled to something, but then there is a medical recommendation that you have something else. It's not a question of understand we're not trying to quiz you or anything, but, you know, for members of the public at large who do, unfortunately, suffer this impediment, if the minister can simply find out the doctor concerned, then again, speak to the patient as well. The opportunity of saying, well, look, you know, I could go for this other version. You know, some people are a bit worried of what it looks like, and they'd like a hearing aid that won't be seen. I'm not, at my age, I'm not aware about that. I just want one that works, you know, especially if it works with the loop system, which it makes about difference in your life.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, as I said, I'll be happy to go back to the audiology department. As I said, given the remarks that the Honourable Gentleman has made, it may be that there is a difference of opinion between the clinician and the patient as to what model the person wishes to be ordered, and the view of the clinician may differ from that of the patient, who may, in the instances that have come to my desk, request a smaller hearing aid, which the clinical advice is would not be sufficient for their purposes. And that may be the reason why passive payments are made, but I will confirm the answer for you.
Question number 153, the
Honourable Andrew Phillips. Can the government state where mammography appointments have been cancelled without advance notice to patients?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, routine mammography screening appointments were regrettably cancelled recently due to the unexpected failure of the equipment. All patients affected have been contacted and advised of the reason for the cancellation. Patients have been informed both by post and by phone of the newly scheduled appointment date.
Mr. Speaker, this arises from just over 5 persons that became very concerned by the fact that they hadn't received such notifications or early notifications to be described, and effectively turned up to the hospital expecting to have this procedure done when they were informed that it would be in April, sometime in April, for the machine to get back online as it were all fixed. And obviously their concern was that, you know, this is obviously a delicate procedure for many women that have to undergo this procedure, and therefore we want the clarification as to why there would have been a mishap, a 5 of them at least, I've been told, at the very least, have been affected by this. But if they don't refer to us, that they have been communicated separately and through multi-mediums and things like that.
I think that the point I would suggest is that we're talking about routine mammography screening appointments. So that we're not talking of urgency trials or anything of the sort. This relates to appointments for routine screening. As a result of the breakdown of the mammography equipment, the appointments for these routine flights have to be scheduled. I always insist when rearranging meetings, whether you're bringing them forward or back, that you call the person. And I'm assured that the department made a point of calling every single lady. Of course, there may have been cases where you have been unable to contact the lady for whatever reason. Maybe the number that you have is a landline and not a mobile, or maybe you caught the mobile and there's been no one to pick up. But, and then a letter would have been sent and there would have been no oral contact. But it's always a point, I've always made it a point for the people that called to be told of any rescheduled appointment. For the reason that it says these appointments are important and we would rather minimize any disruption to patients.
Question number 154, the honorable engagement.
The Canberra government said the average waiting time for persons referred to the orthopedic clinic for a routine consultation. The average waiting time for persons referred to the orthopedic clinic for a routine consultation is 11 months.
Question number 155, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
The Canada government said the total number of operations carried out in 2016 and 2017.
The Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, the answer was question together with question 156.
Question number 156, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Canada government said by percentage cancellations of operations due to bed shortages from for years 2016 and 2017. Mr. Speaker, a total number of 3,632 operations were carried out during 2016 and a total number of 3,649 operations were carried out during 2017. The percentage of cancellations of elective operations due to bed shortages for years 16 and 17 are as follows. 2016, 1.79%, 2017, 0.06%.
Question number 157, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government state what statistics it has to hand in relation to the number of children and young adults ages 12 to 25 diagnosed with depression and other mental health conditions? Mr. Speaker, the government has statistics in relation to the type of mental health condition and the number of children and young adults diagnosed with depression and other mental health conditions. These are available on our primary care electronic patient record.
Question number 158, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, further to question 56 of 2018, can the government confirm what its policy is in reducing the high levels of obesity in our community?
I think the Honourable Minister for Health Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, child obesity is an important matter for concern, but the overall levels of adult obesity in Gibraltar is also significant. The government's strategy on the reduction of obesity is therefore designed to meet the needs of different ages, different pressures of society, and different lifestyles. The Public Health Department addresses these needs using a multidimensional approach, including health education, public engagement, and direct intervention. There are numerous ongoing activities, some examples as follows. In health education, the GHO Public Health Department presents several leaflets on obesity prevention, healthy diets, and other health improvement topics on its website, www.healthygibraltar.org, and updates these regularly.
inclusive and healthy diets and lifestyle are placed on display at the primary care centre and within in-bound practices. These are available to the public and regularly updated. The number of TV infomercials are regularly aired in GPC on topics such as the Change for Life initiatives, diets and facts, progress and thoughts. All of these have been produced in the last 2 years. Articles on healthy eating and lifestyles are written for the Chronicle and Insight magazine on a regular basis. The health promotion officers have delivered a series of healthy eating lifestyle sessions to young adults at the Children's College. The healthy eating campaign is currently being offered for year-term students of those high school. The health promotion officers contributed to the citizens advised to run safe campaign to senior citizens of the South District, providing information on healthy living and answering questions. The health promotion officers regularly appear on regular information health care, presenting key facts of contemporary topics like obesity and answer questions. The Public Health Department is working very closely to expand the food and snacks offered in hospital canteen with healthy options. The Public Health Department is working with hospital managers and dietitians to substitute healthy products in the vending machines within the OPA premises. Current calorific food products contribute to obesity and a number of leaflets highlighting the health, environmental, and economic benefits of reducing dietary consumption of meat have been designed and distributed throughout the region. The department is working with the Ministry of Environment on the Conscious Eating and Green Prevention Initiative, which promotes eating for health reasons and wants to protect the environment. Mr. Speaker, further, now inform the House with respect to question 56 of this year that I mistakenly referred the Honourable Gentleman to the Health Matters Report of 2015, when in fact it is the Health and Lifestyle Report, which is available online in the DHA website, and it contains information on obesity. My apologies.
I'm grateful to the Minister for clarifying the position of this year. Obviously, when the Minister said that I could do my homework properly and read it, which I have done, I'm grateful for the correction. But it was right. After reading this document, there is no short, medium, or long-term strategy of the government. It is effectively a statistical analysis conducted in a survey on the health of Gibraltar, effectively relating to obesity, smoking prevalence, eating habits, etc. But it was quite clear from this document that we need to do more to continuously reduce obesity. Some of the levels that have been described in this document, and a summary as well, which is more alarming, which suggests that there is serious concern for the population of Gibraltar, brings significant health risks and likelihood of disease of these people, and consequently increases the future burden of healthcare. And therefore, that is why I put the question as to what is the short-term, medium, and long-term strategy by the government in relation to this, and I'm grateful to Mr. on the specific question. But coming to the question that I was going to put, quite recently there was some debate as to whether increasing activity for our children in schools may well be an option. From either 30 minutes activity levels up to an hour per day, and has the government considered any of those measures that could assist in obesity levels generally reducing them? I've been talking about my learned colleague in the Organized Responsibility for Public Health and Publication. This is certainly something I hesitate to say that we are reviewing physical activity figures and one of the accused of doing yet more things, because obviously it's not a crime for me to try and do anything more than I'm doing already. But certainly this is something that we are reviewing the important effect of obesity on the health and obviously on future budgets. On healthcare is very important, and this is certainly one thing that has been looked at. I'm grateful for the Minister of Education's clarification in relation to those sentiments of children. But quite clearly, our levels of obesity are higher than those in Spain, according to this survey, and Gibraltar has the highest prevalence of obesity in adults at the age of 45. In relation to the countries that were included within this survey, i.e. England, Scotland, and other countries such as Malta and some of the Channel Islands. So it is a significant problem concerning the health of Gibraltar generally, not only in relation to children, but also older males as well, and therefore these are reasons why I've targeted these questions, and hopefully put it on the public agenda, because it's quite concerning when you read in detail
the health and lifestyle report as to the consequences of obesity on our healthcare system, not only for the children, but for a growing elderly population as well, and the burden that it will create. And that is why I'm trying to ascertain the short and medium term commitments by the government in relation to reducing obesity across the wide range of the ages and demographics.
Question number 159, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government state that the location of CCTV cameras situated at Dr. Haraldi home are restricted to the kitchen, cleaning areas, and sitting room?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health Care and
Justice. Mr. Speaker, the CCTV cameras situated at the Dr. Haraldi home are located in communal areas, which include lounges, kitchens, and offices. Can the Minister confirm whether or not any of those cameras would be facing rooms, residential rooms for these particular people that reside in them?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, the answer is no. They will never be pointed towards the personal living areas.
Just so that we get the position clear, we talked about protocols in relation to previous questions of CCTV, I assume, and perhaps the Minister could correct me if I'm wrong, that the protocols deployed by other agencies in relation to the use and limit of viewing CCTV cameras are applied also in the Dr. Haraldi home.
Well, it's best to say that the CCTV, it's not yet operational.
The cameras are not yet in operation, and the care agency are developing their own protocol, relying, of course, on the experience of other agencies, but because we're dealing with a residential setting, we thought it was best to have a particular protocol designed for that setting rather than just relying on other agencies' protocols.
Mr. Speaker, when were the CCTV cameras installed? Or that's at the point they were not operational, they're not switched on. When were they installed? Does the Minister have that information at hand?
They were all installed on the week commencing the 29th of January.
I think so. Question number 160, the Honourable Ed Thomas.
Mr. Speaker, can the government since December 2011 provide details of specialist clinicians who have been providing DHA clinics, including A, the clinic, trust the hospital, the specialist has come, B, the time period the specialist has been, or A, the hosting the DHA clinic?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, since December 2011, the details of specialist clinicians who have been providing DHA clinics, including A, the clinic first hospital, the specialist is from, B, the time period the specialist has been in person, the DHA clinics is in the schedule, I now hand over to the Honourable Gentleman.
Question number 161, the Honourable Telephone.
Mr. Speaker, can the government state whether any patient has been deprived of the appropriate specialist care as a result of the DHA that makes an appropriate resource available?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I can confirm that no patient has been deprived of the appropriate clinical care as determined by the DHA clinical team due to lack of resources.
Mr. Speaker, as I have explained to the Honourable Minister through private messages on some particular cases which I've been informed of, there has been what seems to be a breakdown of communication or a lack of resources being made available. My understanding from what may have happened in a particular case, which we're not going to ventilate in this case, is that a patient has, for some reason, been put into a annual list of reviews, for example, and not been communicated. Can the Honourable Minister please like to investigate circumstances such as this one and ensure that the patient is always aware of the care that person is meant to be receiving and is not left in a vacuum of uncertainty?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I've already carried out the investigation following the Honourable Gentleman's message to me. I have a consultant, the note seemed to suggest that the gentleman in question was informed of the next step. Having said that, I'm working for a note, so I was not present at the meeting where any such communication would have taken place, but it is entirely possible that either the information was not communicated entirely effectively, or that the person didn't quite understand what was being communicated to him. And to assuage the gentleman's concerns, there have been many events, and additional appointments now set for this particular gentleman next week.
We now return to question 113. The questioner is the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Mr. Speaker.
Can the government confirm that the entire £22 million cost of the amount was water treatment plant will be borne by the Improvement and Development Fund and not by whom? I will put the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, the government is considering a number of financing options. Mr. Speaker, I'm sure the Minister is aware that in the last budget was a minimum of £1,000 in the Improvement Development Fund in respect of the wastewater treatment plant. Is the Minister now advising the House that he does not think that the cost will be going to the Improvement Development Fund?
Mr. Speaker, what I'm saying is that we are considering a number of financing options. £1,000 is there to reflect our commitment to it and to leave those options open. If a number of options are open, this could be one of them, but we are not in a position right now to give any more information.
I must say, I'm saying that the Minister announces the signing of a contract. We can't tell us now how he plans to pay for it. We must at least give an undertaking to come back to the House and tell the House how he plans to pay for the contract.
But see, that is not the position. The position is that the government knows it has different options available to it to enable us to pay for the liabilities in the contract, and we want to continue to have those options available to us. When we have made a final decision in the interest of the taxpayer, because we're not going to choose the option that is most expensive, we're going to choose the option that is most in the interest of the taxpayer, who will then be in a position to make an announcement in that respect.
Mr. Speaker, there are two people confusing the cost of the taxpayer in terms of the contract and the way we're going to pay for it. As long as we already signed the contract, there's no further benefit we obtain for the taxpayer, as far as I'm aware. So, in the situation of saying that he didn't give me a letter, I'm going to pay for this wastewater treatment plant at the same time. That is not the position, Mr. Speaker. What the Honourable Gentleman is confusing is whether or not there might be any financing costs attached to the way in which we determine that we will pay for the cost of this liability, or whether we will decide to approach the cost in another way, which might reduce either the financing cost or indeed the £22 million in some way. Mr. Speaker, what he should be saying to me is that he's very pleased to hear that there's an opportunity to ensure that the taxpayer gets an even better deal.
Question number 114, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government state how it intends to reduce the prevalence of tobacco smoking in our community?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, the government intends to reduce the prevalence of smoking in Gibraltar through the following initiatives. Campaigning against the uptake of smoking by children, working through the health promotion team of public health, monitoring the prevalence of smoking in schools, working with the Gibraltar Bags Advisory Council to survey the uptake of substances in schools, supporting the No Smoking Day initiative, a well-established initiative in Gibraltar to promote quitting, promoting smoking cessation in promoting smoking cessation where tobacco consumption is disproportionately high, older men, ethnic groups, minor workers, etc., supporting and promoting the GSA smoking cessation service and increasing the prices of tobacco products.
Mr. Speaker, given this report that I've been reading, because of the Minister's Crossfield reference to it on the last occasion, it's quite clear that our community has one of the highest smoking prevalences compared to any other country studied in relation to this report. I therefore ask the question as to whether the government intends to neutralise the packet containing cigarettes that are banned. And then so you get rid of this advertising of the names on these packets. And also, you've seen in other countries where they illustrate in quite graphic detail some disturbing images relating to tumours and cancer, generally speaking. So does the government intend to do anything about the packaging in relation to cigarettes in order to further enhance our armoury against tobacco and the prevalence of tobacco smoking as well?
There is no doubt that both obesity and tobacco smoking are concerns as reflected in the report, which is the second report that this guy introduced. It was producing my time as health minister. And the first one was also published by us. The survey had been carried out in GST times, but they never provided the funding for publication. So we are very pleased and proud that we are putting this sort of information in the public domain. Because it's of interest to the community, and also it serves as an integrated thing. So, in the same way that, in answer to the previous question, we are promoting different initiatives to help tackle obesity, we are looking at a wide range of possibilities in decreasing smoking in Gibraltar, particularly for young people. These are some of the matters that are on the list of things that have been considered, but we haven't taken a firm decision on those, and that is why the ones that appear in the answer to my questions are the ones that we are actually carrying out at the moment.
I just one further question in relation to that. Clearly, the position in 2008, the percentage of those individuals who had declared themselves smokers was about 28%, but in the 2015 report that the government has commissioned demonstrates that it was 35%. So clearly, something isn't working insofar as strategy is concerned. And in relation to children, of course, the figures are fairly low. And although I appreciate and commend the government for going into schools and telling people about children about smoking in particular, it's quite clear that we need to do more. Does the minister agree with them?
As I say, with anything, any personal environment, of course, I agree, we can do more. We're never going to reach total satisfaction in campaigning and working for things that are good for the environment and good for the health of the community. I think that I'm not sure when we were in a position that we did introduce a healthy environment act. So, although the statistics indicate that there is 2% is more smoking, I would like to think that there is a huge percentage more of non-smokers who are now not exposed to smoke. So overall, perhaps the direction is the right one of your following. But clearly, the community has more to do on this, and we are committed to doing so.
Mr. Speaker, may I ask take this opportunity to ask the minister whether they have made any progress on the question I made about a year ago regarding banning smoking in children's play parks, and then asked again 5 months ago, which is an issue of course of health and environment, as the minister says, because we can educate our children all we want in schools, but if they're living and breathing it in children's play parks, I don't know what example that is.
We did, as my memory says, right, ban smoking in the sports complex. I think that's been read by my friend and colleague, the Honourable Stephen Wise, but I think that's already happened. And we are intending to identify play areas and possibly other recreational areas. We are considering, for example, some parts of the upper rack where smoking can actually be a danger of fire. Perhaps in away from the road and so on to introduce for other reasons, but it's certainly something that we are still considering and hope that we'll be able to see progress to.
Just one final question, I promise, in relation to this. So the government has no intention of standardising the packaging of tobacco products.
Mr. Speaker, I did not say that. I said that this is one of the matters that is on the list of things to look at by way of improving our performance in smoking
statistics. The minister did say part of the strategy would or could be to increase the price of tobacco, especially with demand to work in all jurisdictions, certainly. Is government seriously considering that, or is it the message that the top decision is coming?
Minister for Public Finance, I have raised the price of tobacco more in 6 years than was the case in the past 20. So I think there is an indication of our commitment.
But that doesn't actually answer the question, because clearly if you're considering raising prices to discourage people from smoking, they need to be raised significantly and considerably. And that's why I asked the question. Is the government considering the kind of raises, the kind of levels that we may see tobacco prices have reached in other jurisdictions like the UK, or even possibly Spain, or not?
In the past 6 years, I have raised the price of tobacco more than has been the case in 20 years in this community. And so therefore, I think we have a track record of using price in a way that deters people from smoking. But if people are foolish enough to want to put a stick of grass in their mouth and light it, Mr. Speaker, well, it's very difficult to persuade them. And in the United Kingdom, raising the price of tobacco has meant that people continue smoking. So in a community as affluent as ours, that may not be the silver bullet that honourable members pretend it is. But given that the last time they were in government, they did not take those steps. Can I ask them, at least the Tory Party figure, what do they have changed their minds now?
Question number 115, the Honourable Tian Hammond.
Since question 115 of 2017, has government received a response to its complaint to the EU Commission? What was the failing, etc.? And if so, what was the content of that response? Mr. Speaker, I can be of assistance to the House. I'm just reminded that the increase in tobacco prices in the time that I have been leader of the House is 134%.
The answer to that question, but clearly the government is the question.
Question 115, and answer the Honourable Minister for Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Innovation.
As has previously been confirmed, government has received formal notification from the European Commission that the complaint has been registered and that it is being considered. However, the government has received no further feedback from the Commission since then. The Gibraltar office in Brussels is urging the Commission to expedite a reply.
Question number 116, the Honourable Ian.
Mr. Speaker, has the filtering green underwater camera worked at all since the beginning of last month?
Mr. Speaker, no, sir.
Mr. Speaker, what is the reason for it not having been serviceable?
Mr. Speaker, in answer to previous question, I had mentioned that there was a question of online connectivity. On this occasion, the problem was a little bit more severe. And the guiding team from the Department of Environment and Climate Change inspected the whole length of the cable from the floor to the camera and found that severe weather had dislodged the rock that had fallen on the cable and pinched it. And therefore, it has required the removal of the whole cable, and it will have to be laid again, and the team is looking towards doing it over the next couple of weeks.
I appreciate this may not be answering the question, so I do understand, but does the Minister have any idea of what the cost of that to the exercise funding?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, we have enough cable to be able to reload without having to purchase any more, because most of it can be recouped and used. The work is carried out in house by members of the department's building team, so we don't have to carry over and above the normal wages of the men in question and women in question. So there is no separate cost other than the one that I said last time. Routine maintenance is done by the in house team.
Question number 117, the Honourable Ian Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, what is the cost of each DNA test or backward test conducted on samples of those species?
I'm for the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate and Land Use.
Mr. Speaker, I answer this question together with question 108.
Question number 118, the Honourable Ian Hammond.
Are you fined to be issued or are pending for ownership of unregistered dogs?
I'm for the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate and Land Use.
Mr. Speaker, the cost of each fecal DNA test is €12.88. In answer to question 108, none yet, sir, but I have to qualify that although there has been no fine for unregistered dogs, there has been one fine currently being purchased for an unlicensed dog. You have to register it and then license it every year. So the dog was registered but had not, the license had not been reduced. This is despite the fact that several hundred dog owners have been stopped to confirm their registration and there are daily patrols checking dog owners accordingly.
Question number 119, the Honourable Ian Hammond.
How many meetings of the Heritage Action Committee have taken place since March 2017 and what has been discussed?
I'm for the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, the Heritage Action Committee has met twice since March 2017. Mr. Speaker, my answer, I don't have the details of what has been discussed, but as I have it here, I'm going to read through in order to assist to preempt the supplementary that we know that we can with our name, Mr. Speaker. Discussion of the role of the committee in its method of operation, its terms of reference, and this was in the first meeting, which that slightly predated. So it was a meeting in February, so 3 years together, since I reconstituted it 2 years now. Discussion of the Heritage and Antiquities Act and Government Archives and the Gibraltar Museum and the Garrison Library, the handing in of artifacts found by the public, and Heritage Environment Record, Heritage Management Plan. GIS for collecting the schedule to the Heritage Act, inclusion of codes in the schedule, mobile heritage assets moratorium, the Heritage Act feedback, the sports complex at Europa and Rathley Bank, the Europa Terms of Expressions of Interest, Manswell Acting, Southport Gate from the maintenance of City Walls, the SNOB Gate House relocation, the location of Admiral's Rankers, Ribbon Cemetery, and Street Park Initiative. The World Heritage Museum platform, provision of archaeological services, the Garrison Library again, Rathley Barracks, and Europa Park Battery. So these discussion of heritage aspects of MOD assets. These are the ones listed in our list, so we have been more informal discussions, but I think that highlights the range. If I may add as well, Mr. Speaker, this is an action committee. So it needs when there are specific actions to be decided, but if I let more consultation, with the different members in our day-to-day work.
Just one question, Mr. Speaker. I noticed the reference to a heritage management plan. I don't believe that's been published yet. When might that be published?
Because I think I've answered a question on this previously. This is being drafted by the Virgin Museum team, and I'm looking forward to receiving a draft that I cannot, without notice, I cannot tell the honourable member exactly when I expect it.
Question number 121, the Honourable to England. Question number 120, the Honourable to England.
Can government provide a list of the number of visitors to the Upper Rock by month since July 2014?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, the information requested by the Honourable Member is in the schedule, which I now hand over. In the meantime, Speaker, I would like to bring his attention to the fact that this information is available online at gov.gov.gov.gov/new/statistics. /topic/area/2018/citizen. No, I'm happy to give him a copy of this behind you again.
Question number 121, the Honourable Eric Lammers.
Mr. Speaker, can the government provide an update on the arrears? Can the government provide an update on the arrears due to the provision of service who may have exceeded the service period on offer of entry reserve entrance fees, together with details of any other debts they may owe to the government or its agents?
Office for the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, there is currently one debtor, a real spending amount to £168,790.40.
Mr. Speaker, is that exclusively in relation to Upper Rock entrance fees, or does that encompass other arrears?
Mr. Speaker, exclusively to the Upper Rock, I have not found any other debt by that debtor in other areas. If there are some debts that we have not found, to our attention where he searching the answer.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister confirm that this is the same debtor that owes a substantial amount of money for the last 2 years?
Yes, sir.
And therefore, Mr. Speaker, could I ask what the government is doing in order to recoup this amount of money, given that this is again on the increase, and obviously the operators or whoever the individual is keeps on entering the Upper Rock while having this debt over the government?
Mr. Speaker, this is a snapshot. That debtor is regularly making fairly large payments. This is a snapshot at the time that this information was captured. And it will depend on how many visitors come in, and some months there will be more, some months there will be less. So I suspect that this will reflect a period, because there's a time lag of a couple of months before payments come in. So this could well reflect the end of the summer period. I can't find more information, but I can assure the Honourable Member that payments are coming in regularly. And in answer to previous questions, you will have seen how this does in fact go up and down depending on when we take the actual data. I'm happy to look into a more long-term analysis of this, but I do assure that the Honourable Member that regular payments are being received.
So, perhaps there's an interest charge together with these payments for what could be described as a unsolicited loan.
Without accepting that definition, I'm not aware of what that answer would be. I would need to look into that.
Speaker, this is related to the answer the Honourable Gentleman has given. Doesn't he know, because what he was saying is that payments are regularly coming in, but of course, if payments are regularly coming in,
that the debt remains in the region of 200,000, then effectively the government is subsidizing this particular operator in a very significant way. Now, does the minister know whether, in the period since the summer, for example, whether that debt has actually reached zero? Because then I could understand the situation better, and I could understand that what we have here is an open tally whereby on a monthly or bi-monthly basis or every 3 months the debt may go up and then it could be severe. And I'm just trying to understand what the nature of this debt and how long it's been outstanding is.
Again, having reached zero, but it would be almost impossible to reach zero unless there were no visitors brought by that operator into a local reserve for a period of 3 months. There will always be, it's a dynamic situation, there will always be standard. The debt has been considerably lower than it is now when I've been asked at the time. I don't have a recollection nor the figures at this point in time as to what my answers have been, but there have been. Certainly, at least I think, I'm working from memory, Mr. Speaker, at least part of this. And if you then translate it into the number of tourists brought through, it may be that it is a reasonable amount of tourists if you're working on a 2 or 3 month ramp. So it looks, I think it certainly looks worse than it is, but I would need a little bit of time to research it in the context that it has been last. I was asked for a specific figure, that's what I have provided. I would be happy if the honourable members write to me, there was another question teacher to analyse it in that way. But it is highly unlikely that it would ever be zero if there is a lot of trade. But I need to research that further.
The fact that it can't go down to zero is slightly confusing when this matter was first raised by the principal auditor in his report from 2014-15. And therefore, it was highlighted by the principal auditor as a growing concern, given that it's the only, there were two operators at the time, one obviously has satisfied his debt, but obviously there's still remaining one particular operator, individual out there, that simply can't manage its debt appropriately and has been doing so for now. 2 years when this was not the case before this was actually raised by the principal auditor.
Had the Honourable Gentleman reached that assumption, couldn't it also be the bigger separator by far, rather than just the debt that it is unable to manage its debt?
Pardon, Mr. Speaker, I'm going to the Chief Minister. I take that assumption from the concerns raised in the principal auditor's report. And if he's raising it as a concern, it's obviously a concern which we must then address. And I hope the Chief Minister agrees that if he highlights it, it's something that he should, his government should be looking into.
Nobody's saying it's not a concern. What I'm saying is how his Honourable Gentleman assumes that it is a debtor that is unable to manage debt, and that the sums are not large sums because we might be dealing with one of the largest operators that brings a larger number of people. And the Honourable Gentleman said to him, as a result of that, the numbers get large.
Yeah, I understand the point made by the Honourable the Chief Minister, but you see, isn't there a position that effectively what we're dealing with is a running total of amount owed to the government simply because there are a lot of tourists going into the upper off, and at any given time there's always going to be some money that goes to the government? I could understand there's no concern, but the point that's made by the Honourable Mr. Lamas is that in 2014, the principal auditor raised this as a concern. Therefore, it was a concern to the principal auditor. And if it was a concern to the principal auditor, I think that it's a reasonable assumption to make. We don't know, we're blind on this side of the house in relation to this. The government has the facts, but if it was a concern to the principal auditor in 2014, then a reasonable assumption is that it can't just simply be explained away by way of a total, a round total, that is reasonable in the context of a lot of tourists coming into the upper end. And I just wonder whether
the government knows the answer to this. I mean, are we talking about, which I think from the inferences to be drawn, I don't think that is right, but is the government satisfied that this is just simply a reasonable debt incurred in a round total because of the amount of tourists that are going in? Or is it a matter of concern which the government then is attempting to deal with in any particular way?
The government is satisfied that the money that the principal auditors said were outstanding in 2014 has been paid, and that the money that are outstanding today have been accrued subsequently as a result of the volume of traffic that this particular operator moves, and the credit terms this operator provides to its client, and therefore the credit terms that it requires from the government. But that we're dealing with a going concern that pays the amount outstanding to the government, although unfortunately with slightly greater delay than the government would like to do. But on the notice, this is a complex business. The government has an intention to try and see if they can deal with it in a different way. That's a reason to the situation, but generally. But given the numbers that we're dealing with in the context of this particular operator, it would be wrong to say this is mismanagement of debt. And this is the thing that the Honourable Mr. Yamas said. Now, it's the assumption that Mr. Yamas made that I was challenging. And there are some things Mr. Yamas has said in the House, which I very much welcome that the Honourable Gentleman has taken issue with. This one I take issue with because it's based on our assumption. And as I often say to the Honourable Gentleman, to assume it's an act of you and me. And in this instance, that's exactly what Mr. Yamas has done.
Would the Minister be able to advise what the standard credit term would be for this operator? Is it 30 days, 60 days, 90 days? Because obviously the concern of people would be that they exceeded the credit period.
So the speaker, I believe it's 3 months. And as I say, I've had this report in order to be able to elaborate, to analyze that. This amount of money by 3 months would be at 56 pounds, and then you would have to divide by the cost per visitor to see how many visitors we're talking about. It's difficult to analyze it with all the information. But it is, I believe, a 3 month period.
Does the minister know whether the 200,000 that are outstanding, or 169,000, I stand corrected, that money is outstanding for more than 3 months or less than 3 months? Because if it's less than 3 months, then of course there is less of a concern. But if it's more than 3 months, then there is more of a concern because obviously they're exceeding and breaching their credit terms.
Because I'm not going to speculate. I learned by mathematics from you a few, and without the data, I cannot answer. I would have to look into exactly how this figure has come about.
As a problem with the government, the way the question is phrased, I believe it was inclusive of money owed in the period of 3 months, and therefore the out of credit term amount is going to be significantly lower.
Question 122, the Honourable Alexander. Can the government explain whether it's still pursuing a working upper off to vote on those figures as
well? Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, yes, sir. The Speaker just wants to know if the Minister knows when this act will be raised and what the expected cost will be. When is the opening of the sidewalk, which is at last moment, as we finish the safety work within the area, and the first I would need notice of that, Mr. Speaker.
Question number 123, the Honourable E.
in time for the House to now adjourn until Friday at 3 p.m.
the house for water from by doing a clean water.